from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. China Monday decided to suspend activities of the China-U.S. Cyber Working Group after U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced indictments against five Chinese military officers on allegations of cyber theft. We have this from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
China has suspended activities of a joint cyber working group with the United States following the indictment of five of its military officers by the U.S. Attorney General. Eric Holder on Monday accused these officers of stealing trade secrets from six of the largest U.S. companies, including Westinghouse, U.S. Steel, and Alcoa. Speaking on Monday, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Qin Gang said that the indictment was based on what he termed intentionally fabricated facts. China lodged a protest with the U.S. side immediately after the announcement, urging it to immediately correct its mistakes and withdraw the indictment. Qin said that the position of the Chinese government on cybersecurity had always been consistent and clear-cut. He reiterated that the Chinese government, the Chinese military, and their relevant personnel have never engaged or participated in cyber theft of trade secrets. The U.S. accusation against Chinese personnel is purely groundless and with ulterior purpose. Qin warned that China would react further to the U.S. indictment as the situation evolves.
Many international observers see the U.S. charge of industrial espionage as a case of the pot calling the kettle black. RT's Guyan Chichikayan reports.
For years, the U.S. has warned everyone that the Chinese routers and other internet devices pose a threat because they're built with backdoor surveillance capacity. But the NSA documents released by Glenn Greenwald show that the U.S. has been engaged in doing just that, in doing exactly what it accuses the Chinese of doing. Glenn Greenwald has published documents and photos showing how the NSA routinely receives or intercepts routers, servers, and other computer network devices being exported from the United States before they're delivered to the international customers. The agency then implants backdoor surveillance tools, repackages the devices with factory seal, and sends them on. This allows the NSA to gain access to entire networks and all their users. Well, among other devices, the agency intercepts and tampers with routers and servers manufactured by Cisco to direct large amounts of internet traffic to the NSA repositories. Glenn Greenwald also writes, there is no evidence in the documents that Cisco is aware of or condoned these interceptions. He also writes that the methods serve all agendas, economic, diplomatic, military, and yet, despite revelations that the U.S. has never shied away from spying on anybody, I mean, especially China, Washington brings up new charges against China for spying. And here's how the U.S. State Department responded to the Chinese reaction to this new batch of accusations.
The Chinese statement says, quote, it is a fact known to all that relevant U.S. institutions have long been involved in large-scale and organized cyber theft, as well as wiretapping and surveillance activities against foreign political leaders, companies, and individuals. China is a victim of severe U.S. cyber theft, wiretapping, and surveillance activities, goes on. Is that correct?
Well, our intelligence activities are focused on the national security interests of the United States.
So
we believe there should be a continuing dialogue on these issues with China, which is why we've been so supportive of a working group.
Again, as you see, there's no shying away from the fact that the public is now aware of the scale and scope of the NSA spying, and yet it doesn't stop the U.S. from lashing out at China for spying.
China has taken notice of reports that it is a victim of severe U.S. cyber theft, wiretapping, and surveillance activities, as this report from a Chinese newscast demonstrates.
Does the U.S. spy on private businesses just as it is accusing China of doing? According to former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, speaking to German TV network NDR about German companies in January, the answer is yes.
There's no question that the U.S. is engaged in economic spying. If there's information at Siemens that they think would be beneficial to the national interests, not the national security of the United States, they'll go after that information and they'll take it.
Snowden's documents show extensive NSA breaching of private companies. Chinese tech company Huawei is effectively banned from doing business in the U.S. over fears its software and hardware have technical backdoors that can give the Chinese government access to client information. But a 2010 document leaked by Snowden to the New York Times shows the NSA has itself installed backdoors into Huawei electronic products to discover trade secrets. An NSA document stated, "If we can see how Huawei is marketing itself and working to expand, this will help us to understand the company's plans and intentions." A December 2013 article in Der Spiegel detailed an NSA program codenamed ANT that targeted products by an international lineup of companies that included China's Huawei, but also U.S. firms Cisco and Dell, Korean giant Samsung, and others, without the consent of the companies. And another NSA program, codenamed Quantum, set up two covert data centers through Chinese front companies to spy on Chinese Army Unit 61398, the unit that housed the five soldiers charged in Monday's indictment. In each of these instances, the U.S. used or spied on private companies, but Washington insists the goals are very different.
There is a significant and important distinction between the gathering of intelligence for national security reasons, which the United States does, and surely China does, and virtually every other nation on Earth does, and the gathering of economic data for the purpose of providing a competitive advantage to companies in your own country. That is not something that the United States does.
The U.S. says it only uses intelligence gained from private businesses to better understand markets and economic forces so it can advise U.S. policymakers. But critics say the NSA wants to have it both ways, dictating when and where spying is permissible. Jim Spellman, CCTV, Washington.
Meanwhile, Russia and China are involved in negotiations that insiders say will bring new agreements on trade and military cooperation. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
President Vladimir Putin arrives in Shanghai for a Asia security summit hosted by China. He's also here to show how much he values ties with China.
The most important signal to China that Russia continue to consider China as a main partner, not only in Asian affairs, but in world affairs.
Russia wants to strengthen cooperation with China, to participate in Asian affairs, to push forward its own modernization, and to have a much more influential voice in the world.
Sanctions from the EU and the US over the sovereignty of Ukraine have pushed Russia to give up relying on them and to seek new opportunities in the East. China has its own set of difficulties with the U.S. pivot to Asia and its stances over China's territorial disputes with U.S. allies in the region. A stronger relationship would suit the both neighbors in their strategy to counterbalance the pressure.
China and Russia are not going to form a traditional alliance, yet their relationship is beyond an ordinary one. They support each other in forging closer ties in strategic, political, and economic fields.
Aside from the political motives, China and Russia have complementary economies. China is Russia's biggest trading partner, and there will be steady momentum in pragmatic projects like natural gas. And Russia is the major military equipment supplier to China.
I suppose it's time when Russia and China can arrange some kind of foundation, some kind of background for new security system in the region and give the opportunity to other countries to join this foundation.
The new type of big power relations between China and Russia has sent many signals to the world that the two countries do not want a repeat of the world order in the Cold War, which was based on hegemony and a zero-sum game. They want to promote a more rational and diversified world order.
The U.S.-backed acting government in Kiev is now shelling houses in Slavyansk in a desperate attempt to force anti-government protesters into submission. Press TV's Omaleski reports.
Ukraine's government forces have heavily pounded the country's eastern city of Slavyansk in overnight shelling.
They started shooting everyone and bombing. And that's all. It happened in one night just before I came home. What can I say? Let those Turchinovs and Yatsenyuks be blown to pieces for what they have done. Why do the people have to suffer like this?
The troops stationed outside Slavyansk targeted residential areas of the city. Several houses were destroyed. There have been no reports of fatalities yet. The attack has sparked anger among residents as anti-Kiev sentiments continue to rise. Ukrainian forces are pushing ahead with an offensive against pro-Russia groups in the country's east. The government launched an operation last month against pro-Russia protesters who've seized over a dozen towns. The protesters have declared independence in Donetsk and neighboring Luhansk.
Pro- and anti-government organizers in Thailand were continuing their activities after the army declared martial law early Tuesday. The army chief, General Prayut Chan O-cha, said that the imposition of martial law was not a coup, but was aimed at restoring security. He called on the public to stay calm and urged all sides to stop their demonstrations. We have this report from NHK's Chola Fonsanarula in the Thai capital, Bangkok.
The situation appears calm in the capital, including the business district of Ratchasong, where soldiers have remained off the streets. The military says their decision is meant to safeguard public security. Anti-government demonstrations have been intensifying since last November. The political turmoil took on another dimension earlier this month when former Prime Minister Ying Lakshinawat was dismissed from office. Strict security measures are in place across the Thai capital, where soldiers armed with assault rifles are guarding major government buildings. Troops have also been deployed at the TV station Channel 9, where NHK's Asia Bureau is located. Early Tuesday morning, Army Chief General Prayut Chan O-cha declared martial law via the country's main television channels.
To keep peace and order, we need to bring peace back to the people of every group quickly. I hereby exercise the right under Article 2 and 4 of the Martial Law Act of 1914 to invoke martial law nationwide from May the 20th, 2014 at 3 a.m.
The general stressed that the purpose of martial law was to safeguard public order. People carry on with their daily lives with mixed reactions about the sudden imposition of martial law.
There seems to be no way out of the confrontation between the pro- and anti-government factions. In this kind of situation, martial law is probably unavoidable.
I don't know about the details, but given that the situation has been worsening, imposing martial law is probably better than standing by and doing nothing.
Former Prime Minister Thaksin and his loyalist governments put priority on measures to help poor people in the heavily populated north and the northeast. These regions have been left behind by economic growth. The pro-Thaksin camp hasn't lost a single election since 2001. The middle class in Bangkok and other large cities criticize the Thaksins of buying the elections and wasting taxpayers' money to remain in power. The confrontation between the two factions has been continuing for more than 10 years.
To understand the rising power and influence of Nigeria's Boko Haram, as well as most of the radical Islamic activity in Africa, one should look to NATO's 2011 overthrow of the Jamahiriya government in Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. So says editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka, author of the article From Benghazi to Boko Haram. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
My central argument is that basically we cannot understand the rise and the strengthening of Boko Haram, and indeed most of the radical Islamic activity in Africa, in Northern Africa and into Western Africa, disconnected from the events in Libya. With the destruction of the Libyan state, that created both a political momentum for the rise and the emboldening of the Islamic movement in Northern Africa, but it provided also a material source for training and equipment and for money that strengthened these elements across the continent. So when we look at Nigeria today, there's a direct link between that situation and Libya. And that's suggesting that there aren't serious internal issues to help to explain the rise and the strengthening of that movement. But in geopolitical terms, you can't completely understand it without connecting it, contextualizing it to what occurred in Libya.
In short, the United States and Europe pumped tons and tons of weapons into Libya, and of course the fall of the Gaddafi regime freed up additional weaponry. Now that's spread all over North Africa and beyond.
Exactly, exactly. And the scandal of all of this is that U.S. policymakers understood what they were doing in Libya. They understood that there was significant popular support for their revolution. The only element that was in constant opposition was, in fact, the Islamists. And that was the element that they used based in Benghazi, the Benghazi area being the area that fed the area of Libya in which most of the international jihadists emerged from for years. The U.S. policymakers understood the alliance that they were forming in order to undermine and get rid of the Gaddafi regime. So that's why this whole discussion around the upcoming hearings on Benghazi in the U.S. Congress is so phony in one way, because we know that they're not going to go into the issue in any great depth, because they don't want further exposing of the fact that they were in bed with jihadists in Libya, and that they continue to sleep with these forces went into Syria.
Yes, the Republicans keep on pressing for hearing after hearing on Benghazi, but in a large general sense, there is no difference between the Republican approach to the region and the Democrats.
No, and the hearing that they want to, they're going to keep the focus narrow, basically just so they can pin down the Obama administration and to undermine Hillary Clinton. They're going to just deal with the events around the security issue. They're not going to delve into what the CIA station was in fact involved in Benghazi. They're not going to talk about the kinds of political forces that were involved in the overthrow of Libya. They're not going to make the connection between that involvement and the strengthening of these radical movements across Africa. That job falls to us, and that's what we have to raise, because you're right, there's no difference between those two parties. This is a political circus with one objective, to undermine Hillary Clinton's candidacy, which I don't care about, but it provides us an opportunity to raise up these other serious questions, because U.S. policy in Libya, U.S. policies across Northern Africa are also being replicated in their support for right-wing regimes and right-wing movements across the planet.
In other words, if we do not intervene, the only thing that will be talked about will be the minutia of the death of a U.S. ambassador and not how all of North Africa and beyond has been set ablaze.
Exactly. And it will continue to allow them to avoid those kinds of issues, the alliance that they have formed with right-wing forces across the globe. And it will allow them also to continue to manipulate public opinion, to find these highly emotional but real incidents like the kidnapping of these girls, to wrap themselves in this humanitarian cloak and further their countries in the world.
Yes, the Boko Haram kidnapping of the young women seems to be more useful to the United States even than the mere existence of Joseph Kony.
Exactly, because while Kony played a particular role in terms of helping to condition the American people into accepting more involvement in Africa, the stakes in Nigeria are much larger. U.S. policy for Nigeria is to keep the Nigerian government relatively isolated politically. They're concerned about the growing strength and influence of the Nigerian government. But in terms of security, they're not concerned about what's happening in northern Nigeria. They want an entry point into the southern part of the country where the vast majority of the oil exists, because they have a concern with securing those resources. They know that Mobil, Texaco, Chevron, and including Shell are upset that they are losing something like $6 billion a year from theft and sabotage. And so they want to secure those resources there, which means they have to put down the insurgency, the legitimate insurgency that's happening in southern Nigeria that people aren't talking about.
You're talking about the people of the Niger River Delta, where the oil is.
Exactly.
The Pentagon has announced that it's upgrading its surveillance and drone warfare capabilities over Africa, committing to spend over $350 million to turn a U.S. military base in England into a huge intelligence center capable of coordinating intelligence, surveillance, and consequently drone strikes throughout Africa. The base is already facilitating drone strikes in Yemen and Djibouti, according to reports. The expansion means a heightened U.S. drone threat across the continent. Radio VR's David Kearns spoke with Ed Kinane of the Upstate Drone Action Group in Syracuse, New York, and Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who's best known for authoring a May 2002 memo which described some of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures.
Let me start with you, Mr. Kinane. I'm sure you're aware of the plan to upgrade the facility in England. Are we talking about drone war? Are we talking about surveillance a la the NSA? Are we talking about both? Are we talking about overreach of the executive branch? And how would you look at this?
I think it's all three, as well as other dimensions. My understanding of the base at Croton is that it will be an intelligence nexus hub that will cover Africa, but who knows where else. And, of course, the kind of surveillance that drones perpetrate seems to slide into weaponized uses of drones, which means death and destruction, which means war, which means violations of sovereignty.
Moving on, Ms. Rowley, I'm sure you're also familiar with the announcement, or if only in bare bones, that we're going to be expanding our intelligence activities through the space in England. I assume it's part of the U.S.'s effort to get a tighter grip over Africa. They have something called, I think, U.S. AFRICOM. We can put it in that context, but you may have other thoughts about what it means for the surveillance state, or maybe it's necessary. How do you look at it?
Well, you're right. The Washington Post said it was out of control back in 2010, and that, of course, was long before any of the Snowden disclosures came out. I have to say it's sad to see that there's been almost very little reining in of this massive national security surveillance complex, whatever you want to call it. And it is, as Mr. Kinane just said, it's very much tied with war. Because in the United States, there's been a tiny bit of resentment about the monitoring of American citizens, their telephone metadata. So there is a bill now that is kind of moving out of the House, or it's going to be voted in the House. But none of that touches this foreign surveillance. And that actually also includes American citizens who are on the other side of telephones and emails, etc. There's been no bills or no legislative response to that. In the case of Great Britain, the other countries in the European Union who have been themselves victimized by being spied on by this system that is, Great Britain and the United States and Australia, the Five Eyes, that's going to be where you would think some of the pressure would come from. To actually ask the hard questions of the British, who should then have some oversight over what the Americans are doing on their bases.
Do we know whether or not drone activities are taking place? Mr. Kinane, let me ask you. I think the rumor is that some of the bases, including this one in Croton, are facilitating drone strikes in places like Djibouti, Yemen, et cetera. So we should assume that this is a expansion of U.S. drone war capability?
Well, as you know, drone war, drone use, drone surveillance is mostly classified. It's mostly clandestine. It's very hard to hold accountable. In part, that's just the secrecy that surrounds U.S. military and U.S. intelligence endeavors. It's also that the U.S. uses mercenaries, so-called contractors, in launching drones in different locations, and they are unaccountable to any chain of command. We also have here in the U.S. mainstream media that seems not to have awakened to the concerns about drones, and perhaps that's because they hope to use drones themselves for news gathering and news presentation.
Colleen, can I ask you if we're talking about a parallel surveillance network? Do we know that the NSA, I believe, has its own facilities operating under the UK, and now this is going to be purportedly or apparently simply a Pentagon and therefore a separate operation? Can you enlighten us as to the division of responsibilities or overlap or overkill?
Well, obviously, the CIA and the Pentagon both are involved in the drone program. So there are parallel programs. I think that it depends on the country, and they kind of divvy it up that way. I just wanted to kind of piggyback on Mr. Kanan's comment. One of the reasons why Edward Snowden actually became motivated to become a whistleblower was the drone war, because he realized that this super, whatever you want to call it, massive data collection was actually tied in then to identifying people who would be targeted for drone assassination. And so when he saw that, of course, which goes against all the constitutional due process and right to trial and right against, I mean, all of our rights, I mean, are thwarted by the drone memos that say you can even kill American citizens abroad. That actually was one of the things that motivated him to speak out. So I think it's sad that the American media has not done a better job. They have in some limited way, put out Edward Snowden, the disclosures, especially about the telephone metadata, but they have not done a very good job on the wider implications worldwide.
Let me ask both of you, I'll start with Ed Kinnan. Is there any hope or is there momentum gathering in the resistance to drone warfare that will make itself felt in Washington? Do we find resonance among congressional leaders or elsewhere, or are we having to rely on foreigners to step up the pressure?
Well, here in central New York, where I am in Syracuse, New York, we have Hancock Air Base, which is a Reaper drone hub. And over the last several years, we've had scores of arrests of protesters against the war crimes, which are originating from Hancock Air Base. Hancock isn't the only air base that has its protesters. You know, there's Creech in Nevada, and there's Beale in California, and there's other sites as well. I mean, my hope as a grassroots activist is that this will be contagious, not only here within the U.S., but hopefully in Britain. There will be resistance to this expansion of the drone facilities.
Ms. Rowley, you've been involved in the FBI. I noticed there was an organization cropped up last year. I think it was called something like Honor Your Oath, or at least that was the slogan. They were encouraging law enforcement, military personnel, veterans, et cetera, to sort of honor the oath to the Constitution and resist the extra-legal activities, drone warfare among them, that they're being asked to participate in. Do you think there's some groundswell of resistance that come from within the ranks, or do you see it more from maybe now a little bit, the media, from the public, among politicians? Do you see any hope that we can get some reform?
There have been a couple of drone pilots, notably, who spoke out about, you know, the fact that they were not able to discern civilians and even little children from the targets. You know, of course, we're fed this myth that the surgical strikes only kill combatants, etc. So there actually have been some pilots who have spoken out, as well as about their own issues afterwards and how it affects them. So that actually has helped, I think, a lot in educating people. Right now, we have a nomination of one of the authors of the drone legalization memos, who's up for First Circuit judge in appeal court position, very high level. His name is David Barron. Apparently, he authored two of these memos that said it's okay on the global battlefield to kill even an American citizen. And we have some senators now who have posed some hard questions. Rand Paul has even threatened to filibuster this nomination of David Barron. So some other activist groups have held protests, and I've signed three different petitions about this. So there is some movement, and a year ago there were a couple of hearings. They weren't well attended, but there were some hearings that had drone victims and survivors that testified.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.